Good morning to you. I'm Veronica Rickard. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this morning went to Hawaii to visit the site of a striking discovery by an avian biologist, female-female pairs of nesting albatrosses. In fact, about a third of the pairs at that particular site on the northwestern tip of Oahu are female-female pairs. The paper on the finding generated a huge response. Some gay advocates lauded the discovery as proof that homosexuality was natural. Others derided the paper as bias science that anthropomorphized the birds. The subject of same-sex activity in animals is still shrouded in mystery for scientists and begs the question, can animals be gay? That was the title of the cover story in the Sunday New York Times Magazine, which ran on Sunday, April 4th, and was written by our guest this morning, John Mualim. And we welcome your calls this morning. Do you see same-sex behavior in animals as making a difference in how we perceive human behavior? And why do you think same-sex behavior in animals has been overlooked until recently? You can give us a ring at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And John Mualim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, hi, good morning, thanks.
Well, you visited the albatross colony in Oahu, where a particular nesting site has been getting a lot of attention for its female-female nesting pairs. Can you tell us about what you saw there?
Sure, well, this is a place called Kaina Point, and it's sort of on the tip of Oahu, just at the base of a volcanic mountain range. And there's a colony of albatross there that assembles, you know, every fall in November, and the birds spend most of the year flying, you know, wherever they want, as far north as Alaska by themselves, and then they come back to breed in the fall, and they mate for life. So they find their mate, they copulate, they lay an egg, and then they spend the next several months taking shifts at the nest. One goes off and eats, and one stays with the egg, and then they do that after the egg hatches and they need to feed the chick. And the biologist I was there with, a woman named Lindsay Young, had been studying this colony for several years. It was her doctoral dissertation subject. And it was only a few years in, 4 or 5 years in, that she and a colleague discovered that actually about a third of the nests there, as you said, were two females doing all this, rather than a female and a male. And because the albatross basically looked the same, the two sexes look identical, this wasn't obvious, even, you know, despite all the careful attention she was giving the colony. So what's happening is basically these two female birds are doing everything that a male and a female bird would do, except have sex. Somehow one female is finding a way to sneak off, copulate with a male that's part of another pair, and then come back and raise that egg and chick with a female partner.
So this really took biologists by surprise, didn't it? Because they just assumed, as they saw these couples, that this was a male and a female. In fact, the biologist you talked to was so surprised that she checked it about four times. Why was this such a big deal?
Yeah, well, you know, that was really eye-opening for me. I mean, just one of the things I took away from this story is just how hard the job of a wildlife biologist is. You know, if you are Lindsay Young and you're studying this albatross colony, and you're looking at, you know, about 150 birds in about, you know, 60 or 70 pairs, you just assume that when you see two birds tending a nest, it's a male and a female. You don't think that that's something you need to question. And really the only way it came about is that both Lindsay and a colleague named Brenda Zahn, who was studying another colony nearby, started to see two eggs in some nests. And this was actually pretty disturbing because a female albatross can only lay one egg every year. It's just impossible to lay more than one egg. So the occurrence of two eggs, it just didn't make sense. And it was only after taking feathers from some of those birds at these nests with two eggs and going into the lab and genetically sexing them, looking at the DNA to determine their sex, that they realized that these were in fact two female birds.
And what happened next is, I guess, was certainly surprising to the biologist you spoke with. She published a paper about it, and then just sort of the floodgates opened. This ended up being an incredibly weighted subject for people. What happened?
Right. So this was in the early, I guess, the spring of 2008. The biologist published a paper. There were three authors of the paper, and was a pretty short paper that just basically said, here's what we discovered is happening. It didn't even really go too far to try to explain why it might be happening, just laid out the facts. And what happened was the journal that was going to publish this paper published it pretty quickly. The lead author of the paper, Lindsay Young, said she was sort of surprised at how quickly they put it into the journal. And it turns out that the publication date pretty much coincided with the California Supreme Court decision to legalize gay marriage. And from there, these just coming out at that time suddenly put this layer of a sort of a human society or human morals layer to this paper in people's imagination. And basically, there was just this sort of short-lived eruption of debate and pride and repulsion, pretty much every emotion you can imagine about these birds. People were commenting on the paper like crazy on the internet. Stephen Colbert highlighted the what he called the albatresbians as a threat to American family values, just sort of picking up on some of the hysteria in the culture at the time.
Well, what did the biologist make of all this?
She was pretty shocked. I think you have to understand if you're a biologist, you're not interested. If you're a biologist studying albatross, you're not really particularly interested or even thinking about human sexuality. You're just trying to figure out, here's a behavior that we've never seen before. What could it mean for the albatross? What is it doing for the albatross in an evolutionary perspective? The fact that it sort of looks superficially like, quote unquote, gay behavior, or that, it happens to be coming out at the same time as this Supreme Court decision, really has nothing to do with your work. And I think, on the one hand, to her credit, Lindsay sort of took it all in stride and was just sort of happy that people were interested in albatross in any way. But I don't think anyone involved with the paper expected that kind of reaction or really knew what to make of it.
And she seemed actually incredibly uncomfortable with the idea that people were reading human behaviors in the albatross.
Right. I talked to a number of biologists for this story, obviously, all of whom have studied, homosexual behavior in one species or another. And they all struck me to varying degrees as being really wary of any kind of misinterpretation or any kind of, really labored effort to draw some lesson about human sexuality from their research. To them, they're interested in animals, and that's what they see their work as being about, and they try to be very clear about that because, especially with a subject like, homosexuality in animals, it's just so easily politicized. And that, as a scientist, that's sort of the antithesis of what you're trying to do. You're trying to keep all kind of human bias and anthropomorphism out of your work, not invite it.
On the other hand, this is a new territory for wildlife biologists who are wondering about whether this makes sense in a Darwinian universe.
That's right, and it's interesting because the kind of anthropomorphic bias I was just talking about was actually a real obstacle to the scientific study of this in the past. There was a great book that came out about a decade ago by a man named Bruce Bagnell, who basically just spent years looking through even the most obscure journals, finding, hundreds and hundreds of references to where biologists had observed homosexual behavior in animals, and just showing how no one had really, known what to do with those observations. Some people just sort of explained it away. They said, these animals are practicing, or they're confused, or they're deranged. And it spanned the whole spectrum to people who were just sort of outright anthropomorphizing and homophobic about it, who said, things in their articles, said things like, "Dear God," or "What next?" So it's in a way, it's sort of a benchmark of scientific progress, I guess, that now the scientists who are looking at this kind of phenomenon are so adamantly, safeguarding against that kind of anthropomorphic bias on their own part and on the part of the public.
Well, it's pretty striking, too. I mean, you quote old scientific journals where people were observing this behavior in animals, this same-sex behavior, and they were finding it distasteful. One wrote about watching one ram mount another, and he was just sickened by it. And it's striking how, even from a scientific perspective, people were so unwilling to even look at this behavior.
Yeah, Yeah, there, I mean, there were definitely a few. I mean, most of those that I mentioned are from this book by Bruce Begmal, and there are definitely a few where it's just completely over the top. I mean, there's one of my favorites was this guy studying butterflies in Morocco, who basically watched several male butterflies have in a big group sex, and he said in his report about it that I'm sorry to have to report the same lurid details of declining moral standards and of horrific sexual offenses which are in newspapers about humans. Now it has sort of leached into the butterfly community as well. But really, and those are definitely entertaining to come across. But even more sort of interesting, I thought, were the ones where it wasn't. It wasn't such the scientists weren't as proud or as open about their bias, but where, countless times when sex between two animals of the same sex were described as a pseudo-courtship or a mock courtship, just sort of, marginalizing it as, it's just sort of this blip of nonsense that it doesn't really fit into anything we know about biology.
Well, and E.O. Wilson has taken it a step forward, trying to explain the behavior from a biological perspective. Explain what he thinks.
Right. So, I mean, there's been a number of attempts to try to shoehorn these behaviors into contemporary and longstanding biological theories. And basically the challenge, and just to lay it out, the challenge is that if you think of evolution and sort of making the point of life to pass on your genes, every animal should be optimized and sort of honed towards one goal, which is reproducing. So if that's the case, and if that's what a lot of our biological understanding is based on, why would any animal bother investing in this kind of activity that isn't going to be reproductive and is actually pretty counter-reproductive? And in the case of E.O. Wilson in the 70s, he sort of put forward the argument, well, maybe we can explain this by saying that individuals who engage in sex with the same sex, maybe their role is actually to just help their kin, help their family members pass on their genes somehow, be it by helping to raise young or some other means, so that maybe they're not passing on their own genes, but if their sister or brother or other relatives carry a lot of the same genes, if they can somehow aid those individuals in making more offspring, then this could explain, sort of from an evolutionary perspective, what the role or the meaning of that behavior is.
Are there other explanations out there besides E.O. Wilson's?
Well, one of the more fascinating ones that I came across, which I guess is a much more recent idea, is I spoke to a man named Paul Vasey, who is teaches at the University of Canada, and for 15 years he's looked at this one kind of monkey called a Japanese macaque, and in this species, what you see is the females just mount each other all the time during the mating season. They mount each other almost, or maybe even more than they mount males, I guess. It's really striking to see, he told me. And so, why would they do this? And in this case, he's been looking at it for so long, I think he's pretty confident that he's close to a solid explanation. And what he says is, I can't explain this in a way that's going to make sense. Evolutionary. I can't explain this as an adaption, as something that's going to help the species. His explanation instead is that it's not adaptive. It's a sort of byproduct of another behavior, which is adaptive, which is to say the females also mount males during the mating season to sort of focus their attention on them and say, we're mates. And so they have this capability to mount other macaques, and they've just never evolved any kind of instinct to limit themselves to just males. Mm. They just mount everything. So in a way, he said evolution doesn't create perfect adaptations. There's adaptations, and then there's all these other things sort of hovering around them and hanging on as the gene pool moves forward.
In a way, isn't even saying that much. I think that there's a line in your article where one of the biologists you talked to says there's a lot of slush in the gene pool. In other words, something that this is not an ideal adaptation. Isn't even saying that sort of loaded?
Yeah, well, I guess it's loaded into it. She said there's a lot of slop in the system,
right.
which basically just means maybe, you know, it's loaded in two ways. If you're a scientist, it's loaded because it's saying, you know, maybe evolution isn't as perfect as we think it is. Maybe it doesn't, you know, streamline every animal towards one single goal, but it's got all these hanger-on behaviors too. And it's loaded too because if we're so eager to read these animals' behaviors as a kind of allegory of our own, you know, sexual behavior, to say that, you know, there's a lot of slop in the system, and maybe this homosexual behavior among monkeys is just sort of, you know, it doesn't have a real evolutionary point. You know, that you can draw some dangerous or at least some very unflattering conclusions about that, about human sexuality. In fact, the full quote in the article is she says, there's a lot of slop in the system, which is not the same as saying homosexuality is a mistake. She was very careful to say, you know, that we can't sort of moralize about human behavior just from that evolutionary principle.
How widespread is this same-sex behavior in the animal kingdom?
Well, you know, in a way, no one really knows. I mean, we know that it's been observed in about 450 different species of animals. But that being said, you know, to most of those, you know, we only know that it's been observed, you know, a handful or maybe even once. I mean, this isn't the sort of thing that up until recently, people hadn't really studied this in a concentrated way. So a lot of these 450 species where it's been seen was just someone studying, you know, that man with his butterflies, for example, he's studying something about butterflies and sort of happens upon it. So, okay, there's one instance. Mm. And really, it's not something people were interested in looking at, and it's not something that's very easy to look at either. I mean, you can spend your career studying a particular population of animals and never see any instances of homosexual behavior. But we do know that there's a handful of species where it seems to be, you know, pretty prominent, like this population of albatrosses, where you have a third of the pairs being female-female pairs. That's much more uncommon so far. But then again, you know, maybe we'll see more and more of this as people train themselves to look for it a little more openly.
And you have a great slideshow on the website of same-sex animal couples, including there's some fuzzy bunnies on the first page, and there are chickens and ducks. There's a lot of animals that have been observed in these couplings, at least in that instance, right?
Yeah, I mean, these were some great photographs by the artist Jeff Koons, and I should qualify that if you read the fine print very carefully, the caption there says, no assumption should be made about the animal's sexual preference based on the appearance of his portfolio. So we know, for example, that there has been same-sex behavior among rabbits. We don't know that these two rabbits, though, are necessarily engaging in it.
I see. Okay. Well, let's take our first break right now, and then we'll come back and keep talking with our guest this morning. His name is John Mulallam, and he's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. His article, Can Animals Be Gay?, appeared in the Sunday, April 4th issue. And we're happy to take your calls this morning. Do you see same-sex behavior in animals as making a difference in how we perceive human behavior? Why do you think we want to read so much into same-sex behavior in animals? And why do you think it hasn't been studied until recently? Give us a ring at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert with you this morning. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn as we speak with John Mulallam, a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. His article, Can Animals Be Gay?, appeared in the Sunday, April 4th issue. And we'll take our first call this morning. We have Mary joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Just listening here and just a couple comments. I'll take your response off the air. With the two albatross, I mean, it seems to me that's kind of more like two girls who are roommates and one has a boyfriend. She goes and gets pregnant, and then they come back and they kind of help each other take care of their babies. I don't know. It doesn't sound like lesbian behavior to me. Women do that all the time. And I don't think you can draw inferences from what animals do into the human sexual world. I mean, animals have so many innate things that are part of what they do, and humans have choice and decision making, and I can decide to be sexual or not to be. You just can't make the inference. And you know, there are lots of things that animals do in their world that I just would hate to see us take on. So I don't think that we want to be, you know, ruled by what animals do and what we do in human sexuality, because we have children and things, you know, babies to raise, and you just, you know, animals have so many other things that are going on in that that are just don't transfer. So that's my comment.
All right, thanks for the call, Mary. John Mualim?
Yeah, I mean, I think on your second point, I absolutely agree. I mean, that's in fact, you know, what I hope people will take away from the story, that it is sort of ridiculous that we, you know, look to animals for tips on or guidance or approval of our own behavior. I mean, like you said, that, you know, there's lots of things animals do that I would hope human society never tolerates, like, eating their young in some cases. At the same time, there's lots of things we do that animals don't do that we never think to question, you know, whether they're natural or whether we should be doing. You know, I'm talking on a phone right now. I've never seen an albatross or a monkey talk on a phone like this, but no one's calling up to tell me that it's sinful or unnatural that I'm doing it. I totally agree. And in terms of the first point, I think that's also what's really kind of complicated and interesting about the albatross example, is that, you know, none of the biologists involved are saying, here are lesbian albatross. In fact, they're very, you know, they don't want to use words like that at all. But it is a little more complicated than it initially looks, too, because, you know, if you're an albatross, it's really not just sex that defines your relationship with your mate. And I think in this case, you know, these birds are doing all sorts of behaviors and dances and, you know, courtship things with each other that birds really don't do with any other bird except for their mate. So, you know, whether it's more like a lesbian couple or more like two roommates, I think is an open question, and it's one that's an interesting cultural question. But as far as the scientists are concerned, you know, it's not really something they're asking themselves.
Well, and you can see why gay advocates in some cases would want it to be perceived that homosexuality was so-called natural in the animal world, because I gather that when people think that homosexuality is a biological imperative, in other words, it's not a choice, they're more sympathetic.
Right, yeah. I talked to someone at the ACLU named James Essex, who's, you know, works on a lot of cases involving discrimination against gays and lesbians, and that was his point, is that, you know, we know in surveys that Americans are more likely to discriminate against gay people if they believe that being gay is quote-unquote a choice. And so in a way, it is, you know, very compelling to see animals, you know, having sex with other animals of the same sex, because, you know, you can sort of infer that it's not a choice. At the same time, you know, his larger point was it shouldn't really matter. You know, religion, you could say, is a choice. We don't see animals engaging in religion, and yet we've all agreed as a society to tolerate that. So, you know, while it can be reassuring or a kind of a nice talking point for gay rights advocates, that animals engage in same-sex sexual behavior, it's really kind of a red herring. It's not really the right argument to have as far as he's concerned.
Well, thank you for that call, Mary. And a call from Chet in Athens. Hi, Chet.
Yes, good morning. This is an observation from America's Dairyland. With dairy cattle, if you don't have a bull in the herd, as nowadays people have artificial breeding, if a cow is in heat, we call it heat, the other cows will jump and imitate what a bull would be doing. And I think that kind of helps the evolutionary genes go on, because the farmer then knows, well, this cow needs to be artificially inseminated. So, but that is a very common thing with dairy herds, that the cows will initiate or imitate the male behavior. And your comments, if you wish, please.
All right. Thank you, Chet. Actually, I've seen that, too. Apparently, when you live in Wisconsin, you see a lot. So have they looked at all at dairy herds? It seems like that behavior is pretty
really
common.
That's a really great perspective to bring in, actually. I mean, you know, I didn't look at a lot of the research myself, but it's interesting to note that, you know, some of the first animals where same-sex behavior was really taken seriously from a scientific perspective and studied was with domesticated animals, with cattle. You know, one, because it's probably the easiest place to see it, but also because there's a lot of money involved, and people who are raising cattle don't want to, you know, end up with a bull that's not going to be interested in mating. And so there was a real practical reason to figure out know, why this was happening and whether you could predict which animals were going to engage in it.
All right, thanks for the call, Chet. And on to Anne in Milwaukee. Hi, Anne.
Hi, thanks. Great, interesting topic. I've wondered, I've read in a couple of places, and you know, I'm no scientist, I can't remember, I don't know whether it was journalism or what, and maybe even in A.O. Smith, long time ago, that, yes, you know, the phenomenon is there of homosexuality or whatever you want to call it with animals. But one feature that I think he raised, and it seems prominent here, is that we as humans are changing our ecology, environment, you know, in many ways. One of them is throwing out all those hormones, feeding animals all the hormones, you know, a sort of an imbalanced thing, with the result, maybe, that animals are being, I think frogs were the first thing I heard about, being born with cross-sex traits, or at least enlarged testicles, and maybe enlarged breasts on some of male, you know, I don't know, breasts, you'd have to have mammary animals for that. You can see I don't really know how to ask this question. I cannot imagine, you know, as an aside, I would say that behavior of this kind, homosexuality, seems so reasonable in all of the world. It's like, why would everything have to stay clearly delineated male and female? It seems natural and reasonable that these, you know, blendings would occur. It's not a problem. But does that hormone thing have any kind of anything to do with it, or how does it feature?
All right, thank you, Anne. And Anne, I guess, asking whether what humans are doing to the environment is changing the makeup of animal behavior.
Yeah, you know, it's, I think there's are two issues. There are two separate phenomena. One is homosexual behavior, and one is, you know, animals having either becoming androgynous or having their sexual organs turn out different somehow from environmental pollutants. I didn't come across anyone who's looking at whether, you know, environmental pollutants are contributing to homosexual behavior among animals. I know from some other reporting I've done that there are, you know, there's definitely cases of frogs and fish and other animals who've come across, you know, things like maybe fertilizer runoff. I'm not exactly sure which sort of contaminants, but you know, their sexual organs definitely develop in different and abnormal ways. But you know, I don't know that saying an animal's gender is different or affected has anything to do with whether its sexual behavior is going to be affected. I think those might be two very separate things from a scientific point of view.
Well, thank you for that call. And we will take our next call here from Nathaniel in Menominee. Hi, Nathaniel.
Hey there. How are you guys doing today?
Good. How about you?
Not too bad. Well, I can see that you guys are talking about this and looking at many things that are influencing, you know, the biological perspective of the animals. But I was wondering, if you want to compare the animals to humans, why not look at it from a sociological perspective in terms of, like, achieved and ascribed statuses?
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, that's no problem. Basically, achieved and ascribed statuses are the statuses that we as people achieve as we develop. In other words, you know, getting a scar on the leg or becoming more irritated with cab drivers or things like this that culture and other people influence us to kind of develop and become. And then you have ascribed statuses, which is things that we're born with. Now, a lot of people who are homosexual and pro-homosexual argue that being homosexual is an ascribed status. In other words, something that you're born with. In other words, you don't choose it. It's something, you know, you kind of are. There are lots of other people that say that it's an ascribed status in terms of that, you know, we develop becoming homosexual due to the society we're in, making decisions, stuff like that. Well, the question is that if we compare it to animals, animals do not have such ascribed statuses. In other words, animals are not really making the decision to become homosexual as though we claim people are. And if that is truly the case, then you wonder if humans are becoming homosexual due to society changing their ascribed statuses. In other words, the real question is, and the basics of what I'm asking is being society becoming overpopulated, us influencing each other to become more open, allowing more things, wanting to experiment, is society then setting humans to become born homosexual, or forcing humans or allowing humans to make that decision, such as animals. You know, if animals become too overpopulated, like butterflies do, at least from what I had read several years ago, that a lot of times butterflies become homosexual due to a chemical imbalance because of the way they were born, because of inbreeding or because of overpopulation. So I'm just curious if it's, you know, if you want to compare animals and humans, if it's the same thing.
Okay, thanks for the question, Mike. Some tricky areas there, John Mooallem. And I know that, you know, he started his comment, Mike, with if you want to compare humans and animals. I think the point is that we probably don't. But why don't you take a swing at the call there?
Sure. I mean, I'm not sure I can answer the question. I can definitely give some information that will just maybe even complicate it further. You know, I think at the heart, I guess, as I understand it, of what the caller is asking is about this, you know, nature versus nurture argument. Is homosexuality something you're born with, or is it something that you develop because of, you know, environmental or cultural factors? You know, when it comes to humans, that's obviously you know, incredibly more complicated debate than with animals, only because we tend to live in a much more complex society, and our brains are more, you know, complex, and all that comes into it. I mean, I will say one interesting point is. You know, in a lot of these animal populations where this behavior has been seen, although definitely not all, you find animals engaging in same-sex sex when there's a disproportionate when there's a skewed ratio of males to females. So, in the case of the albatross, for example, there are less males than females in that colony. In a way, you can say it's advantageous to the female birds to pair with other females, because now at least they have a chance of laying a fertile egg and raising it. If they just laid an egg on their own and they didn't have a partner, that egg would not survive, because the bird just could not stay there for the 3 months and tend it. It would starve to death if it just stayed there. It needs another bird to help it. So I guess the question then becomes, you know, would these female birds be pairing with females in a colony where there was a male available for every female? And, you know, we just don't know. I mean, so would that be an analog to human culture? You know, I don't know. Those are questions with no real answers, definitely not scientific answers. But I, like I said, it just sort of provides another little wrinkle.
Oh, we need to take our second break right now, and we'll come back and continue our conversation this morning with John Mooallem, a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. His article, Can Animals Be Gay?, appeared in the Sunday, April 4th issue. And we're welcoming your calls this morning. Why do you think humans so badly want to read morals, messages in the same-sex behavior of animals? And what do you think biologists should consider next? The number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you this Thursday morning on Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk with John Mooallem, a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. We're talking about his recent article, Can Animals Be Gay? And John, in your piece, you tell a story about a fruit fly researcher who discovered something about the effect of scent on male fruit flies, and there was some interesting fallout from his research. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, this was a really fascinating story, and I think it just really, you know, encapsulated all of the kind of issues we've been talking about. This is a guy named David Featherstone, who at the University of Illinois, he's a neurobiologist, and he and a group of colleagues were actually doing research about Lou Gehrig's disease. They were trying to look in the brains of fruit flies to try to figure out if, you know, there was a new way to treat Lou Gehrig's disease, see how brains work, basically. And they found that if a protein in the brain was mutated in a certain way, what it did basically was it affected the fruit fly's sense of smell. And because the fruit fly is attracted to other flies based on smell and picking up pheromones, in a way this sort of confused it, and it made the male fruit flies try to have sex with other male fruit flies. They discovered this totally by accident. It wasn't, you know, they weren't looking for this. They just started seeing their male fruit flies having sex with other male fruit flies and figured out this is why.
So they published a paper, and, you know, he said to me, he said, you know, we're just a bunch of dorky biologists. You know, we didn't think about what this is going to mean. We're talking about the way fruit flies smell. It doesn't seem like it's going to have a lot of implications for gay humans. But instead, what happened was he started getting all of these emails and phone calls. And on the one side, he was compared to Joseph Mengele, saying that, you know, he's going to be switching on and off people's sexualities, and that this is going to be some kind of, you know, oppressive eradication of gay sexuality in humans. And then on the other side, he got people who were, you know, very anti-gay, who were afraid that they themselves were gay and didn't know how to come to terms with that, and felt like, you know, this fruit fly study was finally offering them hope that they might be able to switch off their own, you know, homosexual attraction. And, you know, what it really showed is that, you know, on the one hand, usually we think about, like we said before, people who think that homosexuality is a choice being less tolerant of it in others. But here are these people who themselves were intolerant of homosexuality, but were afraid that they themselves were homosexual. They didn't for a second think it was a choice. If it was a choice, they'd be able to stop it. I think, you know, just seeing, you know, poor David Featherstone in the middle of all this too, it really just spelled out the ways that scientists and the general public are not, you know, always talking or thinking about the same sorts of questions.
And people are actually begging him, some of them, to work on this to create some sort of medication for the brain.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, he showed me a lot of these emails, and they were just, you know, they were heartbreaking. They were, you know, one mother was afraid her daughter was going to kill herself because the daughter was, you know, was starting to realize that she was attracted to other women. And all of these people, for whatever reason, chose to see, you know, great hope in this study about fruit flies, when really, you know, the fruit fly study, you know, again, it was just about how fruit flies smelled. It wasn't something that was going to translate very easily into some kind of, you know, quote-unquote cure for human homosexuality.
Well, clearly people see what happens in the animal world as applicable to the human world, because news outlets are picking up on this. I can't imagine that the general public is scrawling through obscure biology journals, neuroscientist journals, looking for stories about homosexuality. It must be the media is picking up on this, because there is a real hunger to think about how to frame homosexuality in humans.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, and again, you know, I don't think it's, you know, it obviously there is some connection we have with other animals. We are animals. I mean, you know, David Featherstone wouldn't have been looking for Lou Gehrig's disease treatments with fruit flies if there wasn't some way to translate those findings onto humans eventually. But I think the danger is that, you know, we don't always want to be so nuanced about it. We want to draw some kind of direct parallel with these animals. And that's where it really becomes dangerous, because it's not, you know, there are no real direct parallels. As the first caller pointed out, you know, are these albatross lesbians or are they just good friends? You know, well, you know, that's not a question we're ever going to answer. That's more of an opinion than a scientific fact. So when, you know, when we start to try to moralize or you know, validate or argue against our own behavior just from a kind of surface understanding of what animals do, it's really dangerous. Then again, you know, I think it's kind of marvelous to see the real diversity of what animals do. And you know, one biologist said to me, in terms of the albatross, you know, what it really means maybe is just that behavior is flexible, that even something that we think of, you know, as such a core part of our identity, something like sexuality, in animals, you know, it's really not that way. It's just something that you know, it can change, or it's elastic, and in different circumstances or with different animals, it's going to be different than in others.
So it sounds like part of this is that the scientists themselves don't really know how the translation works.
Yeah, I definitely think that's part of it, and it's also that, you know, they're not really always concerned with translating their findings into humans. I mean, right now, Lindsay Young in Hawaii is trying to get funding for 10 years to study these albatross, and that's partly because the albatross live for so long that you need to watch them over a, you know, a long period of time to see generations come and go. But, you know, no, as far as I understand it, I could be wrong, you know, nothing in that 10-year study is going to provide any findings about human homosexuality. It's just about figuring out what's happening with albatross.
Let's take another phone call here. We've got Mike with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how about you?
Doing great. I love your show.
Thank you.
glad you took my call. You know, everybody seems to want to point at one thing and one thing only when they start seeing this sort of activity. I work with wildlife every day and, you know, getting them out of people's houses, bats, raccoons, squirrels, that sort of thing. And it's true, you know, we're animals too, but there's a lot of different reasons animals act the way they do, and animals, birds, people. And I'd like to go over a couple of them, like, you know, dogs, you know, two male dogs displaying that sort of behavior. To me, that's a dominance thing. And when two younger ones are doing it, it's a what I call a teenager thing. It's animals acting like adult animals. They want to grow up, so I call them teenagers because they do things that they normally shouldn't. The scent of a female on a male that just got finished breeding would trigger the response in an animal to try to breed him. The color of birds, since birds, most birds cannot smell or taste, they rely on color. But since a lot of birds, they mate for life, like swans and that sort of thing, at the loss of their other half, they'll take on another, you know, as a sort of a surrogate. They need help, you know, and with the seagulls being a colony type bird, they're more apt to surrogate, like a deer fawn that lost its mother will often be surrogated by another doe. They're a herd animal, and they'll look out for each other. And finally, in the prison system, I worked in the federal prison system for 2.5 years, and you can't really call these women lesbians when they're seeking comfort from another woman. There's the absence of a male. So, in my opinion, that's all they're seeking.
So obviously there's a lot to think about there, a lot of behaviors sticking to your observations with animals in your job. The problem is speaking and attributing causes before we know what's what. I guess even the biologists, as we see with the albatross, are still confused about it. What do you think, John Mualim, about how we have to proceed when we're observing behavior?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's an interesting point, and some of the biologists who are looking at this, you know, in fact, one of the kind of most prominent voices about this issue is saying, you know, maybe it's wrong to think about these things as these behaviors as sexual. Maybe they're more social, or they're kind of cooperation or even friendship. You know, that's all on the table. I think the point is that, you know, for example, when the caller says, you know, I call that the teenager mindset, that they're just trying to grow up. That's you know, that may, you know, that's probably a very valid interpretation for him, but that's all it is. It's just you know, one person's interpretation. It's sort of ascribing a human motivation to the animals, and you know, I mean, I think that's where biologists start. The difference is that then they go kind of look and do really long observations of populations and see whether those things, you know, make sense in a more scientific context. Yeah, all of those ideas, you know, at least most of them that the caller just mentioned, those are hypotheses that biologists are thinking about and testing right now.
Well, I guess the other thing here is that probably the public is looking for scientists to provide some sort of overarching theory that explains same-sex behavior in animals, but it seems as though it's going to be very case-by-case, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what's happening now, is that, you know, basically, like I said, because biologists are sort of running into this behavior accidentally while studying other things in animals, there's no experts in homosexual behavior in all animals. You know, there isn't kind of a universal view of this just yet, and there may never be. You know, as the biologist Paul Vassy points out in the piece, that, you know, these things may just look the same to us. It may just look like gay sex to us in all these different species, but in each of them, what's being accomplished and the motivations for it, may be completely different, and it may just be that we're only going to explain them on a case-by-case basis.
Well, Lindsay Young, you said that the biologist who studies the albatross in Hawaii, she's applied for a 10-year research grant to look at this a bit more. What is she hoping to find next time?
Well, you know, one of the first things they're just trying to find out is, you know, how are these female birds having sex? How are they getting their eggs fertilized? When I was out with her in the fall at Kaina Point, you know, we were basically just going out every day trying to catch some of these birds in the act, trying to see whether the birds from the female pairs were, you know, soliciting sex was one of the words Lindsay used, or whether they were essentially being raped. The albatross, they're very faithful birds, or at least they're believed to be. They usually chase away birds that aren't their partners. So just the fact that a female bird could manage to have sex with a male that's not her partner was really confusing. And when you really get on the ground and spend, you know, most of a day sitting around trying to watch two birds have sex, just hoping that you get lucky enough to see it, you really start to understand just how hard this, you know, it is to understand anything about animals, and really, you know, kind of how miraculous it is that biologists know as much as they do.
And you did get close to seeing, almost seeing what you were looking for. At one point, didn't you see one of the female pairs call to a male who was paired with a female, and it seemed as though maybe she was hanging her, you know, hat out there?
Yeah, we saw, and we did actually see another female bird from a female pair having sex with a male. So we got lucky, I guess. We saw it, and it, you know, we saw that the two birds having sex, it just sort of happened to be right where we were looking, and it didn't look very forced at all. It seemed like, you know, everyone was quite happy to be doing what they were doing, and all, you know, Lindsay could do was write that down in her notebook and put that in with her other data. This was her third year trying to do this, and that was the third time she'd ever seen it. I don't know that three matings is enough to build any conclusion off of. And again, it just really struck me, you know, how hard this work is and how slow.
What kind of response did you get from the article when it ran?
You know, I've written some other stories about animals in the past, and not about homosexual behavior, but just having to do with animals. And I think I'm always just sort of surprised and really happy to see just how interested people are about animals, you know, about reading about them and learning about them. And this was no exception. This seemed to, you know, I guess it the story generated a lot of buzz on the Times website, and I've done some other radio interviews like this. But I think this case is different because, you know, everyone seems to have an opinion about, you know, whether or not, you know, what gay animals will mean about gay humans. You know, oddly, I feel like a lot of the conversations I've had or a lot of the comments I've gotten have been voicing opinions that I write about in the piece, that the debate that I'm trying to cover in the piece has just kind of continued on around the piece, that it just sort of came to life, and people are saying things on both sides that are very close to what people in the piece say.
Well, there's another area in the piece that we haven't had time to talk about yet. Maybe we can do it now before the hour is up. I'm wondering about the research with a certain group of Samoan men that one of the scientists that you profiled is working on. Can you tell us about that work he's doing?
Yeah, this is Paul Vasey, the guy who's studying the Japanese macaques, the monkeys. And he's been doing that. And then at the same time, he's been doing this other research in Samoa about humans. And this is a real special group of people in Samoa where they're called Fafafine. And in Samoa, they're men who are attracted to other men. They're what we would think about as gay men, but they're not thought of that way in Samoa. They're called Fafafine, and it's basically like a third gender. There's men, women, and Fafafine, and they're not discriminated against. They're completely, you know, seen as part of Samoan culture. Whereas they don't want to think of themselves as gay. No one would call them gay. Gay is actually, you know, a pretty repugnant term to a lot of people in Samoa, I guess, is my understanding. And what Paul's done, he's been looking at them, you know, because he found in the macaques that, well, maybe there's no evolutionary explanation for this. Maybe it's not really doing anything for these individuals in the evolutionary sense that they're engaging in homosexuality.
he then sort of, you know, with that in mind, that sort of shaped the way he looked at these men in Samoa. And what he found is a couple things, but just to be really brief about it, he found support for that theory of E.O. Wilson that you brought up at the beginning, that basically these men are more willing to help their female relatives raise their kids. They babysit more often, and pay for school and medical expenses. So they really are in a very human way helping pass on their family's genes, even though they not interested in reproducing with women.
Well, it was a really interesting article, and I thank you so much for coming on and talking with us about it today.
Yeah, thank you.
Talking this morning with John Mualim, a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. His article, Can Animals Be Gay?, appeared in the Sunday, April 4th issue. I want to thank Erica Janik for on-air production this morning, Chrissy Pease for production this week, and Rhonda Fanning for technical direction. Kathleen Dunn will be back with you starting next Monday morning at 9 o'clock. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.